What you just heard was a dramatic reinterpretation of a very real moment that changed the world. In 1928, Alexander Fleming walked back into his less than tidy laboratory in London, fresh back from a holiday. Now, what he saw wasn't something that made him jump or gasp or shout eureka like all good scientists are supposed to do. Instead, he found something that made him curious enough simply to take a second look. Fleming was a doctor and bacteriologist, and he'd been growing colonies of Staphylococcus, a bacteria that can cause diseases in humans, on a Petri dish. If you don't remember them, Petri dishes are those round plates filled with jelly that you might have used in high school biology. But these bacteria had been joined by something else. Spores from a mold, a type of fungus, had landed on the dish and grown into a fluffy circular mass, like something you might find on a rotting piece of bread or fruit. Now, it's said that most other scientists at the time would have thrown out these experiments before going on leave, but not Fleming. He wanted to see what would happen. Now, on closer inspection, he saw that the bacteria around this mold were either dead or dying. You can still see the photo of his experiment online, or if you're lucky, in the British Library. Colonies of bacteria, little dots on a plate, got smaller and more transparent the closer they got to the mold, until they disappeared. This mold was producing something unknown that was killing the bacteria. And that was just the beginning. About 90 years later, give or take, I joined a production of a new and bizarre-sounding musical at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. But if any of you have been to the Fringe before, you'll know that it's full of bizarre new theatre. I'm Graham Richardson, your host for this podcast, and at the time, I had been working as a science communicator for a couple of years. I had degrees in biology and musical theatre, so when my friend told me that her brother had written a musical about antibiotics, microbes, and antimicrobial resistance, aka a global health crisis that nobody was talking about, well, I was curious too. The musical is primarily a piece of entertainment. It has to be to work. So we're making this podcast now to fill in the gaps. The science, the social aspects, the stories of how the musical came to be, and the people involved with antimicrobial resistance. And spoiler alert, that's everybody. Now, you're either here because you've seen the show, loved it, and are curious about the science and the stories behind it. Or you haven't seen it and are curious about why on earth it's happening. Well, you're in a safe space. As you've seen, curious leads to interesting places. The first episodes of the podcast will take you on a whistle-stop tour of the main topics, including a timeline
of how the show came to be.
The mold that changed the world, as the musical was first known, began life as an educational show to be performed by primary school children.
We want the cures and the remedies. Give us wonder drugs.
The musical had two stories at its heart, that of Alexander Fleming's discovery, but also the impending threat of antimicrobial resistance, or AMR, a phenomenon which could result in the breakdown of healthcare as we know it. You know, feel-good stuff for primary school kids. In 2018, when I joined, it had become a one-act show of songs that became earworms pretty quickly. This time it was performed by an adult cast, on a fringe stage that was almost too small for all of us to fit on it. But it did well, and was a success with audiences and reviewers. Now, in 2020, a small health crisis you might have heard about got in the way, and like so many things, a project had to pause and take stock. It also meant that the creators had time to write a full-length musical, which debuted in 2022, reappearing in Edinburgh and, with the support of organisations like the UK Science and Innovation Network, it toured for the first time to the United States of America. One of the key themes of this podcast is evolution, and as you've seen, the show itself has been evolving. When it's performed in New York in September 2024, it will be recognisable, but different at the same time. It's got a new script, some new music, but it's also got a new title, Lifeline. And I promise I'll try and use that instead of Mold. But the project's been evolving offstage too. You see, we don't want people to stop thinking about the show and the subjects it brings up when they leave the theatre, or if you're lucky, the after party. We want people talking about AMR, antibiotics, and the big problems which affect us, no matter how overwhelming they seem at first. We want them to be inspired by the bizarre world of science theatre. So I made this podcast, but I haven't been doing it alone. I've been talking to people who know a lot more about the subject than I do. In this episode, I'm joined by Maren Hunsberger.
My name is Maren Hunsberger, and I have a master's in science communication, but I also have a master's in medical microbiology, which means that I love to study all of the tiny invisible things that can make us sick and keep us well.
And Jake Robinson.
I'm a microbial ecologist and also what's called a restoration ecologist. So the first part means I study microorganisms and how they interact with the human body but in beneficial ways. And the restoration ecology side means that I basically study ways to restore and repair degraded ecosystems. And often that involves kind of collaborating with microorganisms.
I'll tell you a little bit more about their projects later, but Jake humbly did not mention he's also written a book called Invisible Friends, which we'll reference throughout the interview. This podcast is going to dive into AMR itself, but before we do that, we've got to meet some important characters. Imagine it's like having a curtain call at the beginning instead of the end of a play. Because we're not just going to be talking about people. We also need to talk about microbes, our invisible friends and foes. Thank you, Jake, that live, well, they live everywhere. So who are they? Why are they important? Maren?
So when we talk about microbes, also known as microorganisms, the key is in that prefix in the word micro, which literally just means tiny, basically. It means that we can't see them with our naked human eye. We need something like a microscope to be able to see what they look like and what they're doing. And in the context of medical microbiology, which is what I've studied, so the microbiology of human health, we're primarily talking about microbes that are bacteria, fungi, viruses, and some parasites. So all of these things are too small to be seen with the naked eye, and we have to use special tools to be able to study them.
And that's not strictly true, because there are certain bacteria that you can just about see, so like the largest bacteria in the world. But yeah, I've spoken about in the book that the size difference is massive. So it's like comparing the largest bacterium and the smallest virus is like comparing a poppy seed with a blue whale. The size difference even in the invisible world is absolutely huge.
Now, it took me a minute to get my head around that, because not only are microbes microscopic to us, but from what Jake's saying, it seems that some microbes are essentially microscopic to other microbes. Now, there's going to be some microbes we don't get a chance to talk about, microscopic algae and parasites, and this amazing group called archaea that can survive in really extreme environments, or, as Jake said, environments that would be extreme for us. So what about these three main groups? What do we need to know?
Bacteria are single-celled microorganisms, and they can be found in most environments on the planet, including the soil, the water, the air, and in the human body. And they come in different shapes and sizes, and they can be classified into several groups based on their characteristics, such as their shape. So they can be spherical or rod-shaped or spiral-shaped, and also their ability to produce energy. So they can be aerobic, they need oxygen in order to produce energy, or anaerobic. Anaerobic means they can produce their energy in the absence of oxygen. And bacteria play crucial roles in various ecological processes, such as nutrient cycling and decomposition, climate regulation, human and plant, animal health, all these sorts of things. So they're really important for life on Earth. We also have viruses as well. Some people argue whether they're alive or not. So most scientists would generally agree that they're not alive. But they're still kind of classed as microbes anyway. So these are small, often infectious agents that require a host cell to replicate and multiply. And they consist of genetic material, either DNA or RNA. And they're surrounded by a protein coat called a capsid. I can't remember who said it, but someone said viruses are just bad news wrapped up in a protein. So they're often seen as a negative or a bad thing in, from our perspective anyway, from a human perspective. But many viruses are actually really important and beneficial for us as well. And then we have fungi. So many people might think of fungi as, you know, you see the big mushrooms in woodlands or in the shop. We often eat mushrooms, but many fungi are microscopic. I could possibly say most fungi are microscopic. And you've got molds as well. And these fungi are ubiquitous in the environment. They inhabit various substrates such as soil, decay organic matter, and they help plants thrive. And providing plants with food and water. So microfungi typically reproduce by producing spores, which are often microscopic again, and they disperse by the air, by the water, or by other organisms. And these spores can germinate under suitable conditions, giving rise to new fungal colonies.
Remember, spores giving rise to new fungal colonies was exactly what Fleming found on his Petri dish. One microbe, the fungus, fighting a microscopic, almost invisible war against another microbe, the bacteria. The two competing for resources or survival. You might be able to make a play out of that. So let's get one thing cleared up. Why do we need microbes? What would happen if they weren't there?
Yeah, so the world would... Yeah, it wouldn't exist for very long as we know it anyway. I mean, everything that we see now with the visible eye, so humans, animals, ecosystems, everything has all evolved from a common ancestor, which was a microorganism. So we are our great grandparents times 8 billion or whatever. We're these tiny single-celled organisms. So for one reason, we wouldn't really exist without microbes in the first place. But yeah, again, it comes back to everything you see in nature intimately depends on everything that you can't see in nature. If you get rid of the invisible part, the visible part loses that partnership and will simply fall to pieces. Our health will degrade, you know, things won't decompose, so we'll be knee-deep in gunk before you know it. Microbes are really important for food systems, plant, animal health, climate regulation, all sorts of things. So yeah, they play key roles in keeping us all healthy and alive.
So I asked people what they thought of microbes when they heard the word microbe, what words came to their mind. And this is a beautiful word cloud of those answers. So I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to react to people's responses to microbes.
I love it. I mean, this is very exciting to me because people have not said sick and icky as much as I thought they would. They're on there, but they're pretty small. And speaking of small, small is the biggest word in this word cloud. And we've got tiny, microscope. But I also see the word harmful here, right? I see the word beneficial as well, but that's a little bit smaller. I see the word dangerous. I see the word infection. So I think we do often think of microbes basically as germs, right? Synonymous with germs. And honestly, that makes sense because it is one of the things that we should be most concerned about when it comes to microbes, right? The way that we can defend ourselves against infectious pathogens, that's very important. Things like wearing masks, washing our hands, getting vaccinated. But I think it's equally as important, and this is my sort of passion as a microbiologist, is to rehabilitate microbes' reputation and to help people understand that they also defend you against others like them, right? We have a whole set of internal microbes that form our defensive barriers against external microbes that might be bad for us.
You heard Maren mention the word pathogen there. Now, we're going to go into more detail on that later. So for the moment, let's call pathogens bad microbes, microbes that can make us sick. Everything from the viruses that cause really annoying colds to the bacteria that cause deadly diseases like TB and anthrax. She also mentioned the microbes living inside of us. These collectively are called our microbiome, and there are lots of them. Bearing in mind that we have 30 trillion human cells in our body, that's trillion with a T, estimates suggest that there are 39 trillion bacteria living inside and on us. So are we just living in a microbial world? How does our relationship with them work? And are they good for us, or are they all just tiny parasites?
Well, I first studied parasitology, actually, and that's a form of what's called symbiosis. So this is where two different organisms live in close association with each other. And again, when I was studying, it was all kind of symbiosis was either like between, you know, a bird and an ox, for instance, or it was the parasitology side of things. So, you know, small things causing harm to different animals. And I started reading around it, thinking like, are there other kinds of symbiosis, surely? And there's so many different forms of symbiosis in the invisible world. And that's what got me really excited. So this kind of close association with each other, where actually both partners can benefit each other. And that's what we're doing really in this, yeah, you say the microbial world, which many people say. So microbes benefit us, but we also benefit them by providing them with nutrients, with a house, basically our human body, our walking ecosystems. So yeah, it's this two-way sort of reciprocal relationship, really. So we are really interconnected. It's not like one of us are in the other's world. It's kind of, yeah, we're all interconnected.
In that word cloud, I also saw the word everywhere, and that is true. Microbes are literally everywhere. I think many people may have heard the word microbiome in the context of human health, maybe in the gut microbiome, for instance. That's a very popular topic right now. But literally everything on Earth has a microbiome. Plants have a microbiome. The soil has a microbiome. Water has a microbiome. So what that means is every single area on Earth and on your human body and inside you has its own community of microorganisms that make it work. Every single piece of you has its own thriving community or cast of characters that interact with the tissue there, interact with your immune system to keep that area functioning properly.
It might be strange to think about it, but this concept of a microbiome means that your body is a collection of ecosystems for microscopic creatures. Now, an ecosystem essentially means a collection of living organisms and the habitat they live in, which is you. You're just like a walking Serengeti or a Great Barrier Reef, and your microbiome are the organisms that live there. And just like lions and gazelles on the plains of Africa have a relationship with their habitat, well, the microbes inside of us have one too. To stretch this ecological analogy a little further, I asked Jake to describe two more ecological terms, niche, or niche if you're American, and biodiversity.
Niche is essentially all the requirements that a particular species needs in order to survive in an ecosystem. So it can be all the resources. So we're quite generalists, so we have quite a general niche. But there are also specialists as well that require quite a narrow set of conditions in an ecosystem to survive. You can find some microbes that live in your gut that also do okay in the natural environment. So they'd be more generalists, or they'd have some strategies for being able to survive both of those different conditions. But then you might again have specialists, like you mentioned. So you might have some microbes that are really specialized at only living in your gut or only living on a tree. I mean, they just differ in the sense that they have genes that allow them to thrive in those particular environments. So you might have some microbes that have genes that encode for certain proteins that protect them from, you know, stomach acid, for instance, whereas the ones in the trees might not require that. But the ones in the trees might require something else that's tree-related.
When an organism finds its niche in a working ecosystem, it carries out a job, which is another way the word niche is sometimes used. Jobs include microbes in the gut breaking down foods that we can't. Microbes in the trees might produce chemicals that help them grow towards the sun. Organisms adapt to their environment through genes, codes which are read by our cells to make proteins with different functions. If microbes have specialist genes that let them survive stomach acid, they might find a niche in the stomach. If they don't, they might be destroyed instead. That's just survival of the fittest. Now, back to Jake.
Biodiversity is just the variety of life on Earth. So all the different species that live on the planet is referred to as biodiversity. And so in general, biodiversity is often considered important because it's the kind of foundation to ecosystems. So lots of species have lots of what's called functional genes, and this allows them to have different roles in the ecosystem. So if you have lots of different species, then you have lots of different functional roles in the ecosystem, and it's more likely just to, you know, hold itself together, essentially. And the same thing occurs in the human body. So we have certain microbes that provide certain functions in our human body. So they aid in digestion. They provide chemicals that allow our cells to communicate with each other. All sorts of different things. So the microbes that are in us, like, you know, the trillions of different species, lots of them are playing important roles in keeping us alive. One reason a diverse microbiome in the human body is important is because it can, the species that are there then can outcompete incoming pathogens. The mechanism by which this occurs is that the diverse species that are already in your microbiome, they starve the incoming pathogens. So they essentially say there's no room at the table for you to dine at. So that's one reason we need biodiversity at the microbial level. Another reason I mentioned in the book is due to what's called the old friends hypothesis. And this is where, you know, we've been exposed to diverse microbes from the environment over thousands and thousands of years that we've co-evolved with. And certain microbes have played an important role in regulating at what's called our innate immune system. And this is basically, it's called non-specific immunity. So in the absence of regulation by these microorganisms, it's thought that our immune system will just attack ordinarily innocuous things like dust or pollen or cat hair or even our own human body's cells. And that's what manifests as an autoimmune disorder. So we need these microbes to play an important role in regulating our innate immune system. And then there's the adaptive immune system as well. This is the other part of our immune system. And we need to be exposed to as many different species of microbes from a very young age as possible, because it trains our adaptive immune system. It provides these tiny armies of immune cells which memorize all the things that the body's been exposed to. And then this allows the immune system to mount a much more efficient response when it encounters pathogens or similar looking microbes in the future.
Like, is it easy enough to say that there are some examples of microbes that we just don't have so much in our body anymore because we don't live in natural environments, or is it a bit more difficult?
Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, it is a bit more complex than that. But in general, it's thought that we're less exposed to a diverse range of microbes because we're chopping down habitats, getting rid of forests and meadows, etc. But we're also, like I said, something in the book about, we're also sticking ourselves in these concrete cubes stacked on top of one another. So we're kind of separating ourselves from the natural world, but also socially as well. We seem to be afraid of getting dirty and getting outside, etc. So these kind of physical and social barriers that are preventing our bodies from being exposed to the kinds of species that we used to be in ancestral times.
When I read first the old friends hypothesis, and it I think it's like, for me, was the thing I just hadn't come across before in the book at all, and it was really fascinating to read about. But what that's meant is, when I've been outside and passing a tree or a bush, I kind of just stick my face into it now and try and get a good whiff.
Give it a whatever hug. It is. Give it a hug.
I don't know if that's
reason.
What you meant, but that's what's happened.
Yeah, excellent. Good to hear.
So if you ever see me outdoors being weird, there's a 50-50 chance that's what I'm up to. Now, what's clear is that a diverse range of microbes in our body carrying out their different jobs is good for us and our immune system. There's been plenty of research, some of which I read, some of which other people have read for me, that suggest that a less diverse or disrupted gut microbiome ends up being bad for our immune system, as Jake said, and even for our mental health. Now, each part of our body is a different niche for microbes to fill. Some areas are moist, some are dry, some have lots of oxygen, others have none. Drifting into a world of analogies, I described to Marin my thoughts in these different areas, and changed my mind on some of them afterwards because I thought of something better. So, the skin is like a castle, maybe Winterfell from Game of Thrones. It's on a frontier, a bit sparse in resources, but with a diverse group of workers making it function as a defence against invaders. The lungs are a bit like a hotel. There's loads of microbes coming in and going out, but not many staying very long inside. The gut is a food factory, with a wide range of workers helping us produce the things we need. I asked her to stretch the analogy to her own speciality, the vaginal microbiome.
Oh, I love these analogies, Graham. These are the best. I love a factory for the gut because those bacteria in your gut are essential to breaking down your food, and they literally produce products that your body can then use. And if they weren't in there, we wouldn't be able to digest our food half as well. We wouldn't be getting as much nutrition. We wouldn't be able to have all of the nutrients that we need to thrive and grow as humans. From my perspective, the vaginal microbiome is almost like this is going to sound really weird, but basically like a spa. So the bacteria in the vaginal microbiome are working really, really hard to keep that environment at very specific conditions. And those specific conditions are anti-inflammatory, like non-inflammatory. They're trying to keep everything chill, keep everything calm, basically, is the role of the vaginal microbiome. The bacteria that live inside the vaginal tract are always producing this substance called lactic acid. You may have seen that in like skincare products. Lactic acid also is a part of the fermentation process for like dairy products. So it's a very common compound, and it, as the name might suggest, is acidic. So it's on the acidic end of the pH spectrum, and that is where the vagina's pH wants to be. That's where it's happy. That's where it's healthy. And that's because an acidic pH makes the environment inhospitable to pathogens or to things that just shouldn't be there. So when we talk about vaginal pH and keeping it balanced, that is not only for someone's like personal comfort, but also because the vaginal pH literally defends against things like invading yeast. So it would keep you from getting thrush. Or studies have shown that there is literally defensive properties of lactic acid and the natural bacteria of the vaginal microbiome against sexually transmitted infections. So people with a naturally more acidic pH in the vagina are less likely to contract things like syphilis, chlamydia, and even HIV.
If you grew up to believe that microbes were synonymous with germs, bad things to be wiped out by various chemical-smelling cleaning products, hopefully hearing about your microbiome has done something to combat that idea. Microbes help us carry out vital functions and even protect us from their cousins that cause diseases in humans. And that's something that the show has had to come to terms with as well. In the original version of the musical, the only microbes represented were pathogens.
When we use the word pathogen, we're saying that that microbe is something that makes us sick. And in some contexts, a virus or a bacterium is always going to be pathogenic. So for example, tuberculosis is always pathogenic in humans. It's not a natural part of our microbiome, so it's not doing anything in our bodies to keep us healthy or help our lungs function. It's an invading bacteria that is transferred from different species sometimes, and often from human to human, that is always going to be pathogenic or always disease-causing. The potential to cause disease.
Now remember, we're currently talking about pathogens that cause diseases in humans, and what might be pathogenic to us might be vital or completely neutral to a whale or a tree or a worm.
From your past domination, our plans have evolved, synthesized adaptation.
I made my first appearance in the musical as a soldier, infected, even possessed with Staphylococcus. The chorus and dancers portrayed other malevolent microbes trying to wage war against humans under the leadership of Plague, also known as my friend Sarah. Now, there really wasn't much room for grey areas here. The microbes were the baddies. In 2022, the most recent outing, the bacteria had evolved. They were now represented by two dancers in colourful, flowing costumes, and they looked nothing like their military counterparts from the old show. Yes, their infection still resulted in the death of people on stage, but there was nothing malicious in their actions. They were simply, and understandably, fighting to survive. So, weighing up the evidence, can we categorise any microbes as good or bad?
In biology, there's no hard and fast rule that applies to every single thing every single time. So for example, there are viruses that are just bad for us. Like the flu virus, in no context, is good for us. It's not a natural part of our microbiome. It doesn't live inside of us. It's not supposed to be there. It's going to make us sick no matter what. I mean, unless you have a very strong immune system and it, you know, your immune system can evade it. The flu is always a pathogen, for example. But I think, especially in the context of bacteria, which is, again, my particular area of passion, I love my little bacteria. There are so many more of them that are good for you and that are supposed to be there than there are quote unquote bad ones. And I think it's specifically in the context of bacteria that we maybe need to start moving away from these ideas of good and bad.
See, I have been thinking about that a little bit. It's kind of too basic if we want to think about it from a really sort of hardcore scientific perspective, because some scientists would argue there are no good or bad, they just exist, they just are. And it's a kind of value-laden label, isn't it? So it depends on your perspective. But I think it is also, it's okay sometimes when you're trying to communicate the fact that there are actually some microbes that aren't doing us harm. So if it's a social label, so if something's actually beneficial for us, then you automatically think it's good or bad. So it depends on the lens that you look at it. In certain contexts, it can be seen as quite a hindrance, but also it could be quite important just to communicate the fact that not all microbes are killing us.
What I would want people to know is that less than 1% of all the bacteria we know of are pathogenic, meaning that they could ever make you sick. The vast, vast, vast majority, many of which we probably haven't even discovered yet, which is so exciting, are good for you and are necessary or are totally neutral, right? They're out there in the world doing their own thing, being good for a plant somewhere and have no bearing on human health whatsoever. But all of the bacteria, the vast majority of the bacteria inside of your body are working with you to make you able to do the things that you have to do as a human.
But because those few species do cause diseases, and that's when we found out sort of 150 years ago, we've sort of been hell-bent on wiping them all off the face of the planet without really understanding the rest of them. So it's kind of understandable that once we didn't know anything about microbes, and then all of a sudden we did, and we knew that a few of them cause diseases, it kind of created this hysteria, I suppose.
There are also microbes in our microbiome, and let's take a bacteria, for instance, that are pathogenic in some contexts, but not in others. So, for example, Staphylococcus is a bacteria, and we probably have all heard of Staph, which is the shortened version of that name. Staph has many different kinds of species. So Staphylococcus aureus, Staph aureus, Staph A, is one that we're particularly concerned about because it is very easily spread, and it's one that has become very problematic to treat very recently. But it exists very naturally on many people's skin. Many people are carriers of Staph A, meaning they have Staph on their skin. It's just a natural part of their skin microbiome, and it's not making them sick. So in that context, for those people, Staph is not a pathogen. But if it were to get somewhere that it's not supposed to be, or maybe inside some broken skin, for instance, so it naturally exists on the surface of the skin, but say someone were to get a cut and their immune system is maybe a little bit weakened for some other and that Staph gets into the bloodstream, then Staph isn't supposed to be there. And in that context, it would be a pathogen. So it has the potential to make that person very, very sick because it's in the wrong place. So when we talk about microorganisms or microbes, it isn't a case of some microbes are bad for you, some microbes are good for you. It's a case of some microbes are bad for you in a certain place, and maybe they're good for you in another place. Some microbes are good for you in one place, but if they get somewhere they're not supposed to be, then you might have a problem on your hands. So it's not a case of good and bad. It's a case of wrong bacteria, wrong place, wrong time. Or wrong virus, wrong place, wrong time. Wrong microbe, wrong place, wrong time.
The same thing happens for microbes that live inside you peacefully until they're given a chance to take over. And sometimes it's us that presents them with that chance.
So for example, one pathogen that's really problematic for folks undergoing medical treatment, especially cancer therapy, is called C. diff, or Clostridioides difficile. That is a microbe that under normal circumstances, maybe, like if you had your natural gut microbiome in place, would probably just be kicked out. Like it would just maybe pass through you because the existing microbes in your gut would be taking up too much space, too many resources, and C. diff wouldn't be able to establish itself there. But in folks undergoing cancer treatment whose gut microbiome has been hugely depleted because they've been on antibiotics, because they've been on chemotherapy, which depletes their immune system, C. diff moves right in and is so difficult to get rid of. It's one of the diseases that we've started treating with a gut transplant, a microbiome transplant, because it doesn't respond to antibiotic treatment. Antibiotics being the medications that we use to kill pathogenic bacteria that would make us sick. And C. diff doesn't respond to those very well. What does work is literally transplanting someone else's gut bacteria into the person who is ill. And that's the thing that kicks the C. diff out, because those quote unquote good bacteria that are supposed to be there move in, take up lots of space, take up lots of resources and say, what are you doing, man? Get out of here, and help your body get rid of the pathogen, the bad bacteria that shouldn't be there. So in that case, I think it is okay to use the words good and bad, just in contexts where it makes that relationship a little more clear. But those gut microbes are doing all of the good work on behalf of your body and your immune system to get rid of that bad quote unquote C. diff. But funnily enough, if some of those gut bacteria got into a place they shouldn't, such as the urogenital tract, they would give you a UTI, in which case they would be considered pathogenic. So, you know, swings and roundabouts, ups and downs.
Okay, so sometimes microbes are good and bad for us. But that doesn't mean they're good or bad in general. They aren't working specifically to protect us or kill us. They're doing what they need to do to survive in a functioning ecosystem. And without many of them, their homes, our bodies, wouldn't work.
But I mean, also all these things we've been talking about, microbes, they hold our ecosystems together. There's a chapter in the book called They Are the Glue That Holds Our Ecosystems Together. So if you think of it from this perspective, they have such a profound effect on our lives and our ecosystems that, yeah, that's quite a humbling thing to think about.
There isn't a visible representation of microbes in the newest version of the show, so they don't get the chance to appear as goodies or baddies. However, when you watch the musical, remember that microbes are still represented on stage, and in their trillions. Without them, there wouldn't be a performance. The actors simply wouldn't be able to carry on without their thriving microbiomes. I felt it was important to do this episode, because after you listen to the next couple, you might forget all the good things microbes can do. We're going to be focusing on some pretty tricky pathogens. Ones that have taken the fight to survive so seriously that they've pushed us into a major health crisis. And there's one particularly important feature about microbes we haven't talked about yet that lets them do this.
So if you picture the human lifespan, right, we become sexually mature, you know, really at 14, but like most of us don't start having babies until 20s and 30s. So that replication frequency is very low. For bacteria, they're replicating themselves, literally dividing themselves in half, you know, thousands of times, even millions of times faster than humans do. So if you picture how humans evolve, right, it's every generation provides the opportunity for mutation in your genetic code. That means you're different from the previous generation, where bacteria, because they're dividing so fast, have many, many, many more opportunities per time increment for their genetic code to change and to mutate and to develop, you know, just little unique things that help them survive.
Ah, yes, I knew I put those beeps in for a reason. For context, you heard them about 30 minutes ago, if you've been listening to the show all in one go, and I mean, why wouldn't you? It's been one hell of a ride. Now, in that time, let's say an average bacteria might have divided twice, providing two opportunities for their genes to mutate and something about them to change.
And I think a lot of people may think of evolution or natural selection as this idea that organisms are evolving things to help them in the world. But really, all mutations are random. And it's just as a matter of if the mutation is helpful, then more of those bacteria survive than the bacteria that had a mutation that wasn't helpful. So the mutation itself gets passed along to future generations, and those future generations get better and better and better at surviving the conditions that are trying to kill them, including things that we humans have created, such as antibiotics or medications that are meant to kill bacteria that are making us sick.
These mutations are behind antibiotic or antimicrobial resistance. I promise we'll look at the difference between the two next time. The fact that bacteria can reproduce so quickly means that there are lots of chances for them to become resistant to antibiotics, to beat our life-saving medicines.
And then the other aspect is that they have a skill that I really wish we had as humans, Graham, and it's called horizontal gene transfer, or HGT. So if you picture, again, humans, we pass our genes down generation by generation by generation. So if you picture a family tree, right, your grandparent, your parent, and you, that's a vertical transfer of genetic code. What bacteria can do is, yes, they're passing their genetic code on to further generations of bacteria, so they're doing it vertically. They can also transfer their genetic code horizontally, meaning they can transfer it directly to another bacteria that it did not create. It's literally, I'm not even joking, literally handing a piece of genetic code outside of one bacterial cell and poking it into another bacterial cell. And it's just a thing that bacteria do in communities to help them all survive the conditions that they're collectively undergoing. It's incredible.
Imagine if you wanted to change your eye color to a beautiful deep mahogany, and someone could just give you the genes to do that. Imagine now if there's a drug designed to kill all of us, but someone else has resistance to that drug built into their genes. If they could just hand it to you, you would also be able to survive. This is essentially what happens with microbes. Due to their fast rate of evolution and ability to move genes between themselves, they can develop and pass on defenses to important drugs like antibiotics. This is one of the drivers behind antimicrobial resistance, and it's a problem for us.
Antimicrobial resistance has certainly crept up. It is a real and proper problem. And I know that we have had children in the UK die during their treatment for cancer because of antimicrobial resistance, because we couldn't get on top of the bug. And there will be patients throughout the country, children, grown-ups, who die because of that.
Next time on the Lifeline Project, we dive into antibiotics, antimicrobial resistance, and the prospect of 10 million deaths a year by 2050 due to AMR if we don't get a handle on the problem. Thanks so much to our guests today, Maren Hunsberger and Jake Robinson. If you want to read Jake's book, it's called Invisible Friends, and it's all about microbes, the environment, and nature connection. He's also got a second book coming out soon called Tree Wilding. And if you want to catch up with him directly, you can find him on Twitter at @Jake_Robinson. Maren's got a PBS show which has just come out on the PBS Terra YouTube channel, and it's called Fascinating Fails. And if you want to catch up with her directly, you can find her on most social media platforms at Maren Hunsberger, except for TikTok, where she's at Maren Microbe. The Lifeline Project was produced and recorded by Graham Richardson, with original music and editing support from Robin Hiley. You can find out more about the musical on social media at Lifeline Musical and at lifelinemusical.com.